This is the podcast of Theophilus Church. For more information, visit our website at theophiluschurch.com.
And we'll give you guys a second to find it if you want to follow along. Tonight we're reading from Acts 27. We're starting in verse 13 and going through the end of the chapter, verse 44. When a gentle south wind began to blow, they thought that they had obtained what they wanted. So they weighed anchor, and they sailed along the shore for Crete. Before very long, a wind of hurricane force called the Northeastern swept down from the island. The ship was caught by the storm and could not head out of the wind. So we gave way to it and were driven along. As we passed to the lee of the small island called Clod, we were hardly able to make the lifeboat secure. When the men had hoisted it aboard, they passed ropes under the ship itself to hold it together. Fearing that they would run aground into the sandbars of Cytrus, they lowered the sea anchor and let the ship be driven along. We took such a violent battering from the storm that the next day they began to throw the cargo overboard. On the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, the storm continued raging and finally gave up all hope of being saved. After the men had gone a long time without food, Paul stood up before them and said, "Men, you should have taken my advice not to sail from Crete. Then you would have spared yourselves and this damage and loss. But now I urge you to keep up your courage, because not one of you will be lost, only the ship will be destroyed. Last night, an angel of God, whom I serve, stood beside me, and he said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar, and God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you. So keep up your courage, men, for I have faith in God, and this will happen just as he has told me. Nevertheless, we must run aground on some island.' On the 14th night, we were still being driven across the Adriatic Sea, when about midnight, the sailors sensed that they were approaching land. They took soundings and found that the water was 120 feet deep. A short time later, they took soundings again and found that it was 90 feet deep. Fearing that they would be dashed against the rocks, they dropped four anchors from the stern and prayed for daylight. In an attempt to escape from the ship, the sailors left the lifeboats down into the sea, pretending that they were going to lower some anchors from the bow. Then Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, 'Unless these men stay with the ship, you cannot be saved.' So the soldiers cut the ropes and held the lifeboat and let it fall away. Just before dawn, Paul urged them all to eat. For the last 14 days, he said, 'You have been in constant suspense and have gone without food. You haven't eaten anything. Now we urge you to take some food. You need it to survive. Not one of you will lose a single hair from your head.' After this, he took some bread and he gave thanks to God in front of them all. Then he broke it again and he ate. They were encouraged and they ate some food themselves. Altogether, there were 276 of us on board. When they had eaten as much as they wanted, they lightened the ship by throwing the grain into the sea. When the daylight came, they did not recognize the land, but they saw a bay with sandy beaches, where they decided to run the ship aground if they could. Cutting loose the anchors, they left them in the sea and at the same time untied the ropes that held the rudders. Then they hoisted the foresail of the winds and made for the beach. But the ship struck the sandbar and ran aground. The bow stuck fast and would not move, and the stern was broken into pieces by the pounding of the surf. The soldiers planned to kill the prisoners to prevent any of them from swimming away and escaping. But the centurion wanted to spare Paul's life and kept them from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first to get to land. The rest will get there on planks or in pieces of the ship. In this way, everyone reached the land in safety." And this is the word of the Lord.
Hi, welcome to church. I'm really glad you're here. This has just been just a real crazy couple weeks, hasn't it? This is it's the levels of like craziness kind of just are never ending. We, as you know, so last week, a week and a half ago was Hurricane Harvey. Cameron alluded to that he spent some time there this week. Even as we speak, if I was to pull my phone up, I suspect that there would be updates. Right now there's Hurricane Irma is just going crazy right now in the kind of Florida, the Caribbean, or over Cuba. It's insane. And of course, this last week there was a major earthquake in Mexico. A couple hundred people died. And then that on top of, I teach at Warner Pacific a class, and I have a number of students in that class who are feeling the effects of major kind of changes in our country. People who are here and wondering if they're going to be here forever, if they're going to be able to allowed to be here for a long time. And then compounded, really, it just doesn't end. And then the fire this week. I guess I just felt really strongly. It's really interesting how many stories in the Bible there are about storms. It's a lot of them. And I felt like it was appropriate tonight to look at one of those storm stories, because I don't really know how else to relay or describe the what it all just feels like. And so I want to talk about the gift of the storm. And this sermon tonight might actually really, I'm hoping that it has a direct impact even on three families in our church who have been displaced by the fire even this week, who are here. And I want to try to look at this story, and I want to see if it's possible for us to understand that God is actually present in the storm. A Wednesday was a really hard day for me. It was my only son's first day of kindergarten. It's a really funky emotion, putting your kid, he wanted to go on the bus. Most kindergartners don't want to go on the bus. He really wanted to go. I think it was because he thinks his new backpack is really cool. He wanted to go on the bus. He wanted to be on the bus. And we took him to the bus, and he got there, and we're still kind of helicopter parents to a certain degree. So we drove to the school while he was on the 5-minute bus and waited for him to get off. And he was really excited to see us after that 5 minutes. So we got off, and he's there, and we take him in. He's got great teacher, great students. One of his buddies in the neighborhood is there. A little Roman, he's there, and then Quinn and I, we drop him off, and then we just go into the car and just cry, just cry, because, it's a unique thing for parents of an only child, and Quinn and I probably won't be able to have kids. Again, it's a really unique feeling to know that your son's first day at school is also going to be your last first day. It's a first and a last. And we took him, and he came back, and he had homework on the first day, and felt really cool about that. There's something sacred about allowing your child to be affected by other people. And it's a really scary emotion to let your kid kind of go. And trusting that this whole process, his first recess, he told us that his first recess was hard. He didn't have any friends, and he was on the recess by himself. And that he cried by himself on recess. And there's something about releasing him into this foreign, scary world, but then having him come home, right? And then he comes home. And I guess I draw that image out that there's a sacredness to absence, because that absence actually creates maturity over time, the hope would be. And there are times for all of us where it feels like God is gone. He's gone. He's dropped us off and he's left. And of course, is God ever absent from us? No, God can never be absent. God is everywhere all the time. He is omnipresent, omniscient. He is always there. But there are times where God intentionally, and I actually think theologically that this is true. There are times where God intentionally puts us in places where it feels like we are alone. We're not alone. But that there are times where it feels like we're alone. And that in those periods of aloneness, our character and our maturity are developed. But that God's intention would be that we always come home. That we always come home. I would imagine that Paul, in this story that we just read, felt like he was all alone. This was a man who Jesus had specifically called and saved and said, come follow me. Saul gives his life to follow Jesus, and he goes, he leaves everything behind, and he goes and travels and he preaches about Jesus, and he gives all of his life to serving people and preaching the good news. And he goes and he does it faithfully. He spends years traveling. Most people don't know this. Paul actually, the year he wasn't, some of us think about Paul that he was some young buck, you know, like kid, and he was like 35 years old and spry and beautiful and long, you know, hair and wears Birkenstocks. And Paul was like 50, 55 years old when he became a Christian. And talk about a midlife, late life conversion story. He gives his life to Jesus and he goes. And what you find about Paul is you would think that God would reward Paul for his faithfulness at 50, 55. You're going to come and follow me. And that God would reward him in his later years when most people are enjoying retirement, that God is going to give Paul sort of a really smooth last couple 20 years. When in reality, Paul's life of following Jesus is marked by pain after pain after failure after pain after pain after pain. It amounted to the fact that Paul, in one of his letters, says, I bear in my body the death of Jesus. Let me just sort of say what I'm saying, that following Jesus didn't work out very well for Paul's career. It didn't work out well for his body, and it didn't work out well for his sense of security. One could argue that following Jesus for Paul destroyed his life. Destroyed his life. And he's on his way to die. He's literally on his way to Rome. This is the end of his life. He had always dreamt of going to Rome. He'd always dreamt about going to this final place and preaching the good news in the great city of Rome. He's going to go and preach. He's going to go. He's never been there before. It's so beautiful reading the book of Romans, the very last chapter. I preached on this text a couple times because one of my favorite texts, Romans 16, all these names, 27 names. Paul wrote this letter to the Romans of all these people in the city of Rome by name, a city he had never been to. Paul yearned to go to the city. It's his dream to go and preach. And he's on his way to go and preach and on his way to preach, on his way to die. And you know your life is not working out very well when on your way to die, you are in a shipwreck. He's on his way to die and he's in a shipwreck. You can't underestimate how painful it must, you would think, the natural man, the natural woman, to think that you can't even go to your death successfully. You fail on the road to your final death. And so this storm happens. It's the middle of winter. Paul's wondering, I bet no doubt, is my life been worth it? Have I spent my life doing the right things? It's been failure after failure. I'm on my way to Rome, finally, the one place I've wanted to go, and I can't even get there to die. And a hurricane hits. And what we find in the middle of this hurricane is that Paul, in the middle of a storm, finds Jesus all over again. For a few minutes, I want you to consider that God is in the storm. I think three things happen for Paul here. I have to think in three. I'm a preacher. The first thing that I see happening in this story, as Paul is going to die, shipwrecks. As I find it really interesting is they are shipwrecked, about to be shipwrecked. Their actions of beginning to throw things overboard. The text says that as they get closer to this, they know they're going to hit rocks at some point. They get closer. They keep testing the water to see how deep it is. And the further they go, what do? The text says, and they began to throw cargo overboard. Now, it's interesting. They don't pull a Jonah here and throw anybody over water, but they start throwing stuff over water. There's actually some interesting connections between the story and the Jonah story because Paul here actually seems to be a little bit of a Jonah. He's on his way to a place where he's eventually going to meet his ultimate calling, but it's going to require his entire life. And because of the storm, they start throwing things overboard. They start throwing all these things. Why? Because that's what you do in the middle of a storm when your boat's about to wreck, is you start throwing things overboard. Because if you want to survive, the greatest way to limit your possibility of your boat working is keep as much stuff on board as you can. And so they start throwing things overboard. They start throwing the unnecessary things. They start throwing the furniture overboard. They start throwing planks of wood that they don't need overboard. They start throwing bags of maybe unnecessary food that they didn't. And they start lightening their load. They start throwing things overboard in a hope that, well, if we throw this over, maybe we'll be saved. Maybe we'll be saved. This is there's a reason, and I've said this before. You go on any plane now, it's literally FAA regulations. They have to tell you that if this plane is going to crash, don't grab your bag. They have to tell you that because people grab their bags in plane crashes. They would rather have their stuff and die than live without their stuff. They have to tell you that because there's experience of people literally rather than living, grabbing their stuff and holding on to it. They have to tell you, don't take your stuff with you. Leave your bags behind. Lighten your load. Why? Because if you have all your stuff, you're probably not going to make it out of the plane. What do they do? What do they do here that is so unique, that's for us? What do they do here? Here's what I want to say. Number one, I think that storms are God's way of helping us clarify what is important in our lives. Because when you walk through trauma, when you walk through loss, when you walk through a storm, when you walk through something that you can't control and it's being done to you, when you walk through those things, you really quickly begin to figure out what is important and what is not important. Was it Wednesday? Was Wednesday the day? Tuesday. So Tuesday, I noticed that Tuesday was the day that it became clear about the fire. At least that's when I noticed about it. And we have three families, the pastor family, Paul and Emily, who live in Bridal Veil. They had to move to another home, so they were displaced. And then I heard, and I didn't know. So our denomination has this big camp, Crestview, Camp Crestview. Many of you went. Some of you have great memories of that place. Some of you have horrible memories of that place. All sorts of memories in the room. But we'd heard that Camp Crestview, which is like this beautiful camp, potentially could burn. And we actually, the people who care for the place, the caretakers, Liz and Stephen live there. That's their job. They care for that place. That's their job. So I get this, I get this email from our denomination that Crestview may burn. And I call Stephen up and I say, Stephen, dude, are you okay? And they're okay. They all got out. And he goes, but we've still got some stuff there. So it's Tuesday. You and I drove up on Tuesday afternoon. So they've been displaced. And I go with Stephen. And my immediate thought was like, we were gonna be driving through flames of fire, you know, like to save stuff. And I was like, I kind of was excited about it. Mike Quinn, in a sense, because it's sort of like, this is gonna be a great sermon illustration by the time this whole thing is done, right? But I go, let's go. And they have some stuff out there that they needed. And I thought when we were going that they had gotten like most of their stuff. And we get out there and I realized that almost all their stuff is still out there. And that they're literally living on the clothes that they have. And we go out there, and I'm thinking they're going to pack their you know, I'm thinking they're going to pack their car, this little car up with all their clothes. So they have, and we go into their house, and I look at Stephen, and I say, what do you want me to get? We're running around, there's smoke everywhere, we can barely breathe. And I say, Stephen, what do we need? And he goes, I'm going to get some clothes, but I want you to get two things. I want you to go get my guitar, and I want you to help me get our keyboard. And I'm thinking, what a weird thing to get if you're going to lose everything, is those two things. And we're pulling the guitar and the piano out of their house, and we're walking out. And I just sort of, I didn't even know what to say. I said, why this stuff? And he goes, I just want to make sure we have the stuff that we need to keep worshiping. I just want to make sure my family can keep worshiping. Get out of the house, we drive by, buy him a couple of stinking tacos. Gets off to his place. I go, and all week, this image of a man and a family who could lose everything, and all they want to do is make sure they can worship. And I was thinking about if I was in his position, I'd be like, I've got to get my books. I got to get all the books I wrote. I got to get all my favorite trinkets and my toys and my stuff. And when you walk through a storm, man alive, when you walk through a storm, you know what is valuable to you. And in this story, they're in the middle of a storm. They're in the middle of hell. And they start throwing things overboard. But they don't throw anybody overboard. And I think it sounds crazy to say, and I've never been displaced like that. My friends here have been displaced. But I have to believe that when we walk through storms, man, it just makes it really, really clear what is important to us and what is not. Storms clarify your commitments. I think the second thing that happens is that when you walk through a storm, you start getting really close to the people you're in the storm with. Do you notice in this, and I saw this, actually, this is what, it's funny, there are all these natural things that have been taking place recently. Have you noticed that? All this natural stuff. There's this line in Ghostbusters. What's the line when the sun is turning red in the world? And one of the characters goes, is this the end? And he goes, I don't remember the line. Anyways, all this stuff is going on. We keep having like these eclipses and these fires and these hurricanes. And I've had so many of you ask me this week, like, seriously, is this the end of times? Like, are we there? And my response is, absolutely we're there. And we've been there for 2,000 years and we'll be there tomorrow too. It's the end of times. Jesus is coming back. It's absolutely true. And it's been true for 2,000 years and it was true before the storms happened. But something funky's going on. And all this natural stuff is going on. And I had this experience when the eclipse happened. There were these neighbors that I've lived next to as a kid for years. I was at my parents' place. And when the eclipse happened, these people who I've never met all of a sudden became my best friends. We had all this stuff to talk about. We're like hugging each other and like, that was incredible. We'd never met. I'd seen them. They were weird. They lived next to us. I'd never talked to them. And we were out in the front watching the eclipse. And after the eclipse, when it was all happening, it was like we were best friends. It was the weirdest thing ever. Have you ever, is there anybody in the room that was at the Blazer game when they won, when Lillard hit the three at the end of the, okay, Ryan Ashcroft was there. You told me this. When he hit that shot, every single person in that place was best friends. Say that again. Yeah, people like just hugging each other, like progressives, like, you voted for Trump, I don't care, I love you. Like, just like, like people, you vote, I mean, just haters who fell in love. Because when you see something like that, it's like, well, and the truth, and actually, friends, that's what happened. Truth be told, that's actually what happens in disasters. Did you know that? I have a friend of mine who's a psychologist. I've referenced this before. She was telling me once, she's a psychologist, a counselor, she was telling me that people who have walked through trauma together have a friendship that nobody can break. People who survived 9/11 together are best friends. And they have a word for it. It's called trauma bond. It's literally the relationship that is formed when you are with people and you walk through hell with them. And when you walk through hell with somebody and you've been through it, man, you look at each other differently. You see each other differently. You become crazy close. in really good stuff and in horrible things. When you walk through a storm together, you will never forget, those of you that will remember this, you will never forget the people you were with when 9/11 happened. You'll never forget them. When you had your baby, you will never forget the people that were in the room when your baby was born. Those things, you never undo those kinds of relationships. Look at what happens in the storm. Look at what happens when the storm hits. Look at what Paul does. You would think Paul would flip out, run around, helping, like trying to help people, you know, be safe and comfortable. And maybe he's preaching the gospel, which he does a little bit here, but I love what he does. Look at what Paul does in the middle of a storm. The Bible says he serves communion. And this is crazy. In the middle of the storm is raging. And what does Paul do? He goes to his little bag and he gets out a loaf of bread. I love that the loaf of bread wasn't something he chucked. And he gets a loaf of bread and he takes the bread and he breaks it. The text is so troubling, by the way. And the text is troubling because it says that he takes the bread and he breaks it and he gives thanks for it. The word that's used in the New Testament is the word Eucharisto. It's the same word that's used any place in the New Testament for the Eucharist, for communion. Bible scholars have been debating this text for years because it seems to appear in the middle of a bunch of crazed criminals. Paul, in the middle of a storm, gets bread and he breaks it and he serves a bunch of pagans the good news of Jesus. All he can do in the storm is serve communion. Who does that? Who does that? Who in the middle of a storm stops and goes, hey guys, I got some bread in my bag. Let's celebrate Jesus right here. But that's what he does. And they break bread together and they eat. And Paul shares Jesus with them. And what so stinks about this world is often people, friends, when we suffer and we go through difficult times and we go through storms, the last thing we're thinking about doing is going into our bag, getting a loaf of bread, breaking it, and serving to the people around us. And the truth is, that is the gift of the good news, is that when we walk through storms and hell and back, we, in the middle of it, can stop everything we're doing and take bread and break it and say, Jesus has died for you. The good news is for you. The next time you have an argument with your spouse, the next time you have an argument with your roommates, the next time you have an argument with your kid, and you have no idea how to reconcile, you have no idea how to move forward, and it just seems like it's irreparable, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go down to New Seasons, and I want you to buy some locally sourced grape juice, and I want you to get some bread that they have just made, and I want you to go back to the person and do what Paul does here. In the middle of your chaos, I want you to get the bread and get on your knees and break it and say, this is the body and blood of Jesus. I was wrong and I hurt you. Will you forgive me? That is what Christians do. What do we do in storms? This is what we do. We eat. And we drink, and we say thanks to God. I can only imagine that these guys were super close friends after this. Because they will never remember the guy who in the middle of the storm served them bread. And in the middle was whatever storm you find yourself in at any point in your life, whatever crisis you find yourself in, storms not only draw people together, but storms give us this crazy beautiful opportunity to actually find God in the middle of it. It troubles me to no end, by the way, that when Paul actually gets off this boat, he's on the mountain on the island of Malta, and the text says that as he gets off onto the island of Malta, the barbarians there welcomed Paul as one of their own. These barbarians treat Paul the apostle as though he's a king. The irony of the book of Acts is that Paul was often more welcomed by barbarians than he was by the church. And I think in this day and age, friend, church, we have got to be the people who best know how to serve bread in the storm. Because our world is dying. It is dying. It is dying. It's been dying for a long time, but it is dying. And we are the ones that have the bread and the wine. And I think storms, thirdly, they bring us back to Jesus. At least that's the goal. I don't think God creates the storms because he's mean. I don't even know if God creates the storms. I'm not going to get into that. But I do know this. I do know that in so many stories in the Bible, the storms are the context in which people find God. How many times Jesus is with his disciples in the boat and the storm is raging? The storm is just raging. And the disciples look back and there is Jesus napping, which says a great deal about what he's freaking out about. Like nothing. There's never been a point in history where Jesus is like, well, I'm out of options here. What will I do? He's taking a nap. He's taking a nap because, friends, there's no worry when you're sovereign and you're good and you know the end and you know the way the story ends. They look back at him, by the way. There's a part of that story. Some of you have been reading that for years. What does Jesus say? They all look to Jesus in the storm, which that in itself is an act of faith. Because I'll tell you what, in the middle of the storm, so few of us are turning around and looking for Jesus. But they turn around and look for Jesus. And Jesus says to them, oh, you of little faith. And most of us hear Jesus sort of berating them. I actually don't think Jesus was berating them. I think Jesus was looking at their faith and going, there's a little faith there. Nice. In the middle of the storm, you looked at me. And actually, at one point, Jesus said that faith the size of a mustard seed could change the world. I think he's looking at that little faith and he's going, it's about sinking time. You looked at me in the storm. And storms have that ability, friends. I've been in rooms with people as they're dying. And I'll tell you what, death, I've said this. I've never seen somebody on their deathbed convert to atheism because death makes you wonder about God. Storms make you wonder about God. What is going on? Make you wonder about God. And the heart and the dream of storms is that we would do one thing in the middle of our storm. We would turn around and see, Jesus, are you in this with me? And friends, church, Portland, he is always in the boat with you. Always, at no point in your life, at no point in a storm, will you look around and say that Jesus is gone. It may not feel like he's there, and it may feel like he's napping, but he is there. Oh, you of little faith, I pray Jesus says that to me. I want just a little. You know, I want to close with something that I read this week that was that's kind of sticks with me that I think is an apt way to lead us to communion tonight. In the middle of our storm, for the pastors, for the Gomez's, for the Kirkenens, for those in this room who may be undocumented and have absolutely no idea what your future holds, whatever. Those are dramatic examples, but for every single one of us that may find ourselves in a storm. I was reading this week, this Catholic guy, I would recommend him to everybody. He Ronald Rollheiser, he's a Catholic theologian who writes just a lot about the Holy Spirit, which I just really like a lot. And he wrote this little book called it's about being missionaries to your children. How to be a missionary to your children. And the whole point of this book is that we are in this new age. We're in the age of secularity. Or in this age of secularity, where essentially his argument is that our culture has said, a Western culture is increasingly saying, we had God for a really long time, but we really don't need him anymore. We're moving on. We've got better gigs. And Rollheiser, in this little section of this book, he says that the best way for me to describe what is taking place in Western culture right now is that we are like the parable of the prodigal son. We are the son who has received the inheritance of the father, and we have run away. And he goes, we know that we're running away from God. The problem is Western culture has no idea what it's running to. It is running away, but it has no idea where it's running to. We just want to be anywhere else. This week, when I was letting my son go at the bus, we were walking off the bus and he was going into his school. He was greeted by his teacher. His teacher was right there. And Elliot loves to hold our hands. He's always loved to hold our hands. And we were walking up to his class and Quinn reaches down to grab his hand and he looks around to see if other kids were holding their parents' hands and nobody else was. And I'm standing behind and I watch as he puts his hand up and he looks around and then he pulls his hand away. And then he goes, and he grabs her hand. And she walks him in. And I want to say, church, in these last days, these days where the world is dying, it doesn't look cool to hold your father's hand. It's not sexy, and it definitely doesn't do anything for your social status to hold the hand of the Father. But the hand of the Father, the hand of Jesus, is outstretched. And you can hold it. You can. Hold it. Hold it.
You've been listening to the podcast of Theophilus Church. We hope you've been inspired and challenged by what you've heard. For more information, visit our website at theophiluschurch.com.